Okay, even though I have already finished slide 9, which is true, correct? I want to start with it again so that we can get reacquainted with the process and then go on from here. First of all, what is the overall process we're studying? No, that's just part of it. The complete oxidation of glucose is the overall process. That's what this chapter's about. Even though it's, well, you don't even see the title, so it doesn't matter. But it's the whole, that's the whole process, though. That has two major parts, right? What's the first part? Glycolysis, as you can see in this summary slide, and that happens in the cytosol. It does not happen in a membrane-bounded organelle. Now, the second part is cellular respiration, and that happens in a mitochondrion if we're talking about a eukaryotic organism. I say that because eukaryotes did not invent cellular respiration. It already existed before eukaryotes existed. Bacteria first invented this process. And cellular respiration in a bacterium can occur even though they don't have a mitochondrion. And that's because what they do with their these bacteria that are able to do this, they have one membrane to work with, right? Their plasma membrane. And they just fold it back and forth a lot of times to make it seem like it's its own compartment, basically. So they accomplish the same thing that that we eukaryotes accomplish with our mitochondria, even though they don't have mitochondria. And in fact, those bacteria that were first able to do that, those are the ones that got engulfed to become the mitochondria in eukaryotes. But anyway, that's where cellular respiration occurs in a eukaryote, in the mitochondrion, or a mitochondrion. And even though it's already part two of the overall process, cellular respiration is part two, there are three parts to it. So, who can demonstrate that they've been doing what I've said is necessary, meaning looking at this a little bit at a time each day? Who can demonstrate they've been doing that by not looking at notes and telling me what the three parts of cellular respiration are? Or even just the first part? Anyone can anyone tell me what the first part of cellular respiration is? Yeah. By looking at your notes, can anyone not look at the notes? Well, that's not the name. Glycolysis is not part of cellular respiration, so I'm glad we went through this. Some books actually say it is, but it really isn't. Glycolysis happens in all cells, whether cellular respiration occurs or not. Glycolysis is just the part that splits the glucose. Glycolysis means sugar splitting. Splits that 6-carbon glucose into 2 3-carbon pyruvates. That's the end of glycolysis. And in cells that are able to accomplish cellular respiration, which not all cells are, not all organisms are, then cellular respiration will begin where glycolysis leaves off. In other words, the starting point, the starting fuel for cellular respiration is pyruvate, not glucose. Glucose has already been processed in glycolysis to create the pyruvate, which you should think of as only partially spent fuel. It's still valuable fuel. And that's the whole point. That's why the evolution of cellular respiration was so valuable, so helpful, and took off. And that's why so many organisms do it now, because it's so successful. If you take the partially spent fuel that glycolysis spits out, pyruvate, and process it further, you can make a hell of a lot more ATP than the 2 that you get just per glucose, just from glycolysis. It's not listed here as two, but there's only two ATPs produced by glycolysis for every glucose that enters the pathway. Right? You can make a hell of a lot more if you keep using the fuel that's left over, which is the pyruvate. That's what cellular respiration is. The further processing of the fuel. But it occurs in three parts. So back to my original question. What is the first part of cellular respiration? Which on this summary slide isn't even indicated other than by a white arrow. Okay, you can look at your notes and tell me. Go ahead.
Is it oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate?
That's right. It's the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Now, keep in mind, glycolysis happened out in the cytosol. Cellular respiration happens in the mitochondrion. So, in order for cellular respiration to start where glycolysis leaves off, that means the pyruvate, which gets spit out of glycolysis, needs to be transported into the mitochondrion. That's what this white arrow is really indicating, the transport of pyruvate into the mitochondrion. But in the process of being transported into it, that pyruvate gets processed as fuel partially. In the step, part one of cellular respiration, known as the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. So I want you to think about that phrase. Well, actually, we'll return to that phrase in a minute once we get to the... It's a couple slides beyond this, but... That's not just named something for the sake of having a long phrase. The phrase is meaningful, so don't just memorize it. Think about what the words mean. We'll revisit that, though. But notice here that the goal in this overall process is ATP production, right? All ATPs are the same as each other. They have the same amount of energy. They're undistinguishable from each other. But they can be made in two different ways in this overall process. They occur at three different points in this overall process, as you see on the slide. Glycolysis produces some ATP. The citric acid cycle, which is part of cellular respiration, produces some ATP. And oxidative phosphorylation, which is also a part of cellular respiration, produces ATP. So the three parts of cellular respiration, in order, are the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, the citric acid cycle, which can also be called the tricarboxylic acid cycle or the Krebs cycle, and part three, which is oxidative phosphorylation. Okay? Citric acid cycle is ATP, and glycolysis as ATP are produced the same way, or with the same process, I should say. It's not identical. But does anyone remember what the name is for the way that the ATP is produced in these two places? It does start with a S. Yes, substrate level phosphorylation. All right, that produces ATP, but so does oxidative phosphorylation. It just does it differently. So what these two phrases share, of course, is the word phosphorylation. What does phosphorylation refer to? Well, I don't know what you mean by a phosphorus group.
A phosphate
group, yes. A phosphorus is an atom. A phosphorus group would just be a group of phosphorus atoms. Phosphate group is phosphorus and four oxygens, right? That's a functional group. So phosphorylation simply means sticking a phosphate onto something else. And that's done for various reasons. For instance, this is a major way in which enzymes get controlled. They can be phosphorylated or dephosphorylated to turn them on or off. But here, the phosphorylation occurs to what molecule? What is being phosphorylated? What do you have to phosphorylate to make ATP?
sugar?
No. If you phosphorylate a sugar, you have a phosphorylated sugar. And that happens, actually, in glycolysis, as we'll look, as we'll see. Now think about the question. What do you have to phosphorylate to make ATP? Keeping in mind what phosphorylation is. Phosphorylation is what?
ADP
is the answer, yes. When you phosphorylate ADP, you make ATP, because phosphorylation means sticking a phosphate onto something. Well, there's already two on ADP, but you're sticking on a third. That's what invests it with even more energy than ADP had. That's why ATP is a higher energy molecule than ADP. Okay? So the phosphorylation of the phrases substrate level phosphorylation and oxidative phosphorylation both refer to the fact that you are sticking a phosphate onto ADP to produce an ATP. But those two different, there's two different ways in which that phosphorylation occurs. In glycolysis and in citric acid cycle, the ATP produced is via substrate level phosphorylation. When you hear that phrase, what comes to mind? I haven't really told you what substrate level phosphorylation is, but what would you guess about it? What is it? What does the phrase substrate level phosphorylation tell you about? What can you tell me about what that must be, even though I haven't told you what it is yet? If it's called substrate level phosphorylation, what's going to be involved? Write a phosphate, because otherwise it wouldn't be phosphorylation, and a substrate. So, to further indicate that you need to keep current on all this stuff, especially with vocabulary, what is a substrate?
A reactant in a catalyst reaction that binds an enzyme.
Sounds very much like you were reading that from something that you won't be allowed to read from during a test. It has to come from your brain, but you're right. You're right. You wrote down exactly what I said, which is good. But that should be one of these many vocabulary words that you already know. You don't have to look up at all in order to get a grasp on this stuff. Because it grows, and it can, you know, each new bit of knowledge requires you remembering the stuff you've learned before. So a substrate simply means a reactant in whatever reaction you're talking about that gets catalyzed by an enzyme, right? The substrate is the reactant that binds temporarily to the enzyme on the active site of that enzyme to get turned into product. That's all substrate means. Okay, so if we look at the picture in slide 10 of substrate level phosphorylation, now the phrase should make more sense to you. What happens, of course, is a phosphorylation of ADP. But notice that the phosphate that gets stuck onto ADP to make this a phosphorylation is not a phosphate by itself. It's not an inorganic phosphate just in solution. At first, it's a phosphate that's already stuck on something else, a substrate. The green thing is a substrate because it's binding to the purple enzyme, right? But before this phosphorylation event happens, the substrate is already phosphorylated at the moment, right? It already has a phosphate on it. And what it's going to do by binding to the enzyme, the substrate that is, by binding to the enzyme, is going to it's going to lose that phosphate and transfer it to ADP to make ATP. Well, that's not the way it happens in oxidative phosphorylation, but that's the way it happens in substrate level phosphorylation. And that's all that term means. So if you think about what these vocabulary words mean, that it should make perfect sense to you. All right? I'll tell you why oxidative phosphorylation is different when we get to that point. But this is how the ATP that glycolysis produces is produced. And this is how the ATP that's produced in the citric acid cycle of cellular respiration is produced. That's the minority of ATP that's produced for each glucose that gets burnt as fuel originally, though. By far, most of the ATP that gets produced eventually gets produced by oxidative phosphorylation, which is in the last part of cellular respiration. That's the big payoff in terms of ATP. All right? Now, what I meant earlier when I said it's not identical is that the enzyme is different and the substrate is different in these different places of glycolysis and citric acid cycle, but it still is a, some sort of substrate passing a phosphate directly to the ADP to produce ATP. And keep in mind, ATP, once it's produced, that is the goal. It doesn't need to be further processed. It just needs to be used to power whatever you need energy for. Okay, so it's the end of the line. Now we can go to 11 and talk about glycolysis, which is part one of this overall process. Now the details of glycolysis aren't shown here, the biochemical pathway details, that is. Glycolysis is a biochemical pathway. It's not a reaction, not a single reaction. It's 10 reactions. There are 10 steps in the pathway, which, by the way, can also be called the glycolytic pathway. That's just another name for glycolysis. But anyway, the 10 steps aren't shown in this slide. What this slide, though, importantly does show you is that overall as a process, glycolysis involves two phases. The so-called energy investment phase and the so-called energy payoff phase. Now, what is the overall goal of this whole process? To make ATP. To make ATP, not to spend it. But what we see is that in order for glycolysis to happen, or for the whole thing to happen, you need to get it started by actually spending some ATP first, which is exactly the opposite of what you're trying to accomplish. So there's two ATP, and that means two ATP for every single glucose that enters the pathway. So this is, these numbers are per glucose. Two ATP have to be spent. What's another word for spent here that's more scientific than spent? What's happening to the ATPs? Well, it is also used, but that's kind of like spent. What's the? Yes, that's what is the, what's chemically is happening to ATP? Yeah, more specifically. What do we do to ATP to use it? What do we do to ADP to make ATP? Yes. What do we do to ATP to use it? We do the opposite of phosphorylation, which is dephosphorylation. Okay, so when we use ATP, we're dephosphorylating it. Splitting a phosphate off of the ATP releases some of that energy that ATP is carrying.
What did you mean the other day when you said ATP is like money, but ADP is like a debit card?
No, ATP is also like a debit card, but it's a debit card with a high balance. If you spend some of that balance, you still have some money in the account, and that's like ADP. So you could keep spending it, but you don't have as much money as you did originally in the ATP form.
What about AMP?
AMP is like such a low balance that you can't even afford a candy bar anymore.
Oh, man.
So you need to make a deposit if you're ever going to be able to buy anything, is what that means. And AMP, when it starts building up in a cell, that tells the cell you've been spending energy much more quickly than you've been investing it in from extracting it from your fuel. That means you've been turning your ATP into ADP and then AMP. And you're not going to be able to do that and continue to live. So AMP tells the cell you need to really start burning a lot more fuel, release a lot more energy so that we can turn this AMP back into ATP.
Okay.
That's like making a deposit in the ATM, I mean in the debit card account. Okay. So anyway, this energy investment phase requires two ATPs to be dephosphorylated, turning them back into ADP and two inorganic phosphates, because the phosphates have been removed from the ATP, right? They're just in solution now, the phosphates. Is that a question?
Yeah, can you just repeat yourself? It requires two ATPs to be phosphorylated?
To be dephosphorylated. Yeah, ATP already has three phosphates. And when you use that ATP for energy, what you're doing is dephosphorylating it, removing a phosphate. That's what releases the energy, or some of the energy. And that leaves ADP plus the phosphate that you removed, which is now just on its own, inorganic phosphate. Okay, that releases energy. And that's that energy is not energy that's coming out of the fuel. That's actually energy that's going into the fuel. This is an energy investment. Right? It's kind of a backward step in terms of your goal because you're trying to produce ATP. But you can't have the rest of glycolysis happen unless you get through this investment phase. So it's really analogous using money again to the phrase, it takes money to make money. If you invest money rather than just putting it under your mattress, then you'll have more money than you had originally because you earn interest, right? You don't earn any interest under the mattress. In fact, you not only that, but you have the same face value of money, which doesn't buy you as much after inflation. So it makes sense to invest money, in other words, if you want to make even more money. Here you're investing some energy in the form of ATP because doing that then allows the rest of it to happen, the rest of glycolysis, which is the energy payoff phase in which four ATPs are produced per glucose. Okay? So you phosphorylate four ADPs to make four ATPs. Now, it took two ATPs to get there, so you really only are earning two net ATPs per glucose, right? But just for that reason alone, it's worth doing this, because now you have more ATP than you started with. But that's actually the minority of the payoff. ATP is valuable, and that's the goal, but it's carrying a certain amount of energy. Even more energy is carried in these NADs that pick up energy in the form of electrons and protons, as we were talking about last time, from the fuel. Remember, two hydrogens that get picked off are two protons and two electrons. You stick those into a taxi, NAD+, and that forms NADH and H+. Two of those are made. Well, each one individually is carrying enough energy to make multiple ATPs eventually. So this is actually more energy than the ATP. So it's doubly an energy payoff phase. Okay? It's just that NADH is not the goal. NADH is, as I keep saying, a taxi. It's going to drop those passengers off so that even more ATP can be produced eventually. But that happens in cellular respiration, not in glycolysis. The bottom of this slide is just a balance sheet. So in terms of fuel, you start with glucose, you end up with two pyruvates. Well, that's not completely spent fuel. That's partially spent fuel. So that's still valuable stuff, the pyruvate. But glycolysis is done with it. Also, in terms of in terms of nucleotides, you start with ADP and you end up with ATP. That's valuable because it's carrying the energy and it's the goal, after all, right? And you also start with which version, by the way, of NAD is the low energy version? The coenzyme is the NAD. It exists in two forms, right? What is the low energy form? In terms of taxis, is it the empty taxi or the full taxi? What did I say? Low or high energy?
Low.
Yeah, the low energy form is the empty taxi. Now, chemically speaking, which of the versions is it? Oxidized or reduced?
No.
No. No. Reduced. Keep track of this backwards terminology. Reduce means gaining electrons, right? The electrons came from the fuel. They are energy that used to be in the fuel. So they are the passengers. When the empty taxi takes on electron passengers, by definition, chemically, that taxi is becoming reduced, right? It's gaining electrons. So the reduced form of the coenzyme is the higher energy version. The oxidized form is the empty taxi. Lower energy. It's not carrying any additional energy. It's just an empty taxi. Now, which version of NAD is the oxidized form? No, that's the reduced form.
Right, isn't that?
I said which one is the oxidized form? NAD plus is the oxidized form. That's the empty taxi. Remember what I said last time. You've picked off two hydrogens with the help of a dehydrogenase enzyme from the fuel. Two hydrogens, but in terms of subatomic particles, that's two protons and two electrons. The empty taxi is a positively charged to begin with, NAD plus, that's empty. So it takes one of those electrons just to make it NAD. Okay? You still then have one electron and both protons. If you take the remaining electron and one of the protons, that's a hydrogen atom, and that turns it into NADH. Plus, you still have that other proton, which is H+. So the reduced form, the full taxi, you can tell just because it has more letters, is NADH, NH+. Yeah. This is per glucose. Okay, so one glucose fuel molecule turns into two pyruvate molecules and so on. That's for every glucose. Okay, so you have to keep tracking, you have to fully understand what the oxidized and the reduced form are and which one has more energy as we go on to the rest of this process. Slide 12 shows us some of the particulars of glycolysis, but it's overall a 10-step pathway. Here we're looking at just half of it. Specifically, we're looking here at the energy investment phase of glycolysis, as we just talked about. Now, I don't want you in this course to memorize all of these intermediate names. You would have to do that for biochemistry, but not for this course. Because that's really not the point at this stage. The point is what happens with energy, basically. I do want you to notice, though, that these numbered steps each has a word associated with it. What are these words? I can't allow that as an excuse. This one is hexokinase. This is phosphoglucoisomerase. Phosphofructokinase, aldolase, what are those? They're not reactions, they're actual molecules.
Enzymes?
Enzymes, they all end in ASE, right? Those are enzymes. So each individual reaction in a biochemical pathway is catalyzed by its own reaction, by its own enzyme. And notice they're to the side of this downward pointing arrow. You never have an enzyme listed on the before or after the arrow because those are for reactants and products. Enzymes don't get changed into anything. So they get written on a normal arrow that's horizontal above the arrow. Okay? Well, we can see that this is the energy investment phase because two ATPs are being used individually, but at two different places. Right? And what is it that's happening to the ATP in each case? It's being dephosphorylated to release some of the energy it's carrying. But dephosphorylation means the phosphate's removed. Now, phosphate doesn't disappear, right? Notice that it's put into the fuel. You start with glucose that doesn't have any phosphate. When you use this first ATP, you're turning it into glucose 6-phosphate because this is just a glucose with the carbon at position 6 having a phosphate hooked to it. It's a phosphorylated glucose. And in general, when you phosphorylate something, you're investing it with energy, just like you invest energy in ATP when you phosphorylate ADP. Okay, so this energy is not wasted, it's invested. It's put into the fuel, really, making the fuel even more energetic than it was as glucose. Well, these next couple steps don't involve expenditure of ATP, but they just rearrange the same set of atoms. These have exactly the same chemical formula, but they're just isomers of each other, right? So it's just rearranging the skeleton. And notice, by the way, all of these have 6-carbon still. So it's no longer glucose, but it still is a 6-carbon fuel along the way. It's just different isomers. Then you get to another ATP spending step. And notice now you have phosphates in two different places in the fuel. That's why it's called fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. Bis or bi means two. Okay, now it's a doubly phosphorylated sugar. And that is the last time that it will be a complete 6-carbon skeleton. Because when we get to where the number 4 is here, that's where the splitting occurs. That is why it's called glycolysis. Glycolysis doesn't mean glucose splitting, it means sugar splitting. By now, it's no longer glucose. It's still a sugar, though. Fructose is a sugar. And it gets split. So here's where we have part of the using of the fuel. Remember that the complete efficient use of the original glucose fuel molecule means two things. It means completely dismantling the carbon skeleton, and it means picking off all of the hydrogens that are on that skeleton. Well, here we are finally transforming this 6-carbon fuel into 2 3-carbon fuels. So that's part of the dismantling of the skeleton. Okay? It's a fork in the road, though, notice. And that's because at step 4 here, either one, when you split this 6-carbon thing into 2 3-carbon things, there's 2 possible things that you can make. And those are called dihydroxyacetone phosphate and glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, which also goes by the nickname G3P. Those are different from each other, but they have exactly the same carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens as far as numbers are concerned. So they're isomers of each other, right? As these things were of each other before we did the split. But notice that only G3P has a down arrow below it. That down arrow means this can go on to the rest of glycolysis, the energy payoff phase. But dihydroxyacetone phosphate can't. Now, there's 3 possibilities when you split this fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. You can make 2 dihydroxyacetone phosphates, you can make 2 glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates, or you can make 1 of each. Because it's random, kind of, as to which one is going to be produced. But only G3P can go on. It doesn't matter, though, if you actually make dihydroxyacetone phosphate instead of G3P because you can easily convert this isomer into the other isomer. You can convert dihydroxyacetone phosphate into G3P with the help of an enzyme that's named isomerase, telling you that it's isomerizing one isomer into another. And therefore, even though there are two possibilities, it actually ends up being 100% G3P that goes on to the rest of the process. Okay, that's, I guess I should have been pointing to the bigger version, which is a close-up. That's what that means, though. So that's the energy investment phase. Two ATPs have been spent, but now you have fuel that's worth even more than it was originally. 13 shows you the rest of glycolysis, the energy payoff phase. And right away, step one of, well, it's step six overall, but the step one on this slide, there is energy payoff. Because by converting that G3P from the previous phase into this intermediate, two hydrogens get stripped. And those hydrogens, therefore, two electrons and two protons, are able to reduce NAD plus into NADH. Now it says two NADs get turned, NAD pluses get turned into two NADHs and H plus. Why two? It's actually only two hydrogens that get stripped from the fuel. And two hydrogens are required to reduce one NAD plus into NADH and H plus. But it's listed here as happening twice. Why? The answer is that in the previous step, we split a 6-carbon into 2 3-carbon compounds, right? So if you think about it as per glucose that you started with, everything here happens for each of those 2 3-carbon compounds that feeds this process. Right? You start this slide with 2 identical G3Ps. And everything here happens to each one of them. So it's everything's multiplied by 2. That's why it's 2 NAD pluses getting, per glucose, getting transformed into 2 NADHs. You see what I mean by the multiplication here? It's only happening once to each glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. But when you split the 6-carbon compound into 2 3-carbon compounds, you have 2 of those glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates, and therefore each of these things is multiplied by 2 in terms of energy, because it's, these are per glucose calculations. Does that make it clearer? Okay. Well, the very next phase is another payoff, because now you have ADP being phosphorylated into ATP. Look at the structure we had. Remember that we spent 2 ATPs and made a doubly phosphorylated sugar? Those phosphates are still here in the fuel before this second step of the slide, step 7. But now one of them gets removed and gets put onto ADP to make it ATP. There's only one left in the fuel at this point. And then later down here, that remaining phosphate in the fuel gets stuck onto a different ADP to make another ATP. And the same thing's happening for the other version of the fuel because it's split into 2. That's why it's 2 here and 2 here. 4 overall that are produced ATP, but you spent 2 on the glucose originally, so you earn 2 net. All right? Now that gets us to pyruvate, the end of the line for glycolysis. But pyruvate is not completely spent fuel. We have not yet completely dismantled this fuel. That's why it's still valuable. We can keep breaking down the carbon skeleton until it's individual carbons in the form of CO2. Each individual CO2 contains just one of the 6 carbons that were originally in the glucose. And CO2 doesn't have any usable energy for the cells because it no longer has any CH bonds. So not only have we not completed the dismantling of the skeleton, but we haven't yet picked off all of the hydrogens either. That's the other part of using the fuel, right? Dismantling the skeleton, picking off the hydrogens, or dehydrogenating it. That's why glycolysis, if that's all that happens in a cell, and in some cells that is all that happens, there isn't all that much ATP produced. It's a wasteful use of the fuel. Because glucose has a lot of energy in it, if all you do is glycolysis, you're leaving a lot of energy in the form of pyruvate. Cellular respiration is all about recognizing that pyruvate is itself still a valuable fuel, and therefore it starts with pyruvate and completes the dismantling of the carbon skeleton and the picking off of the hydrogens, so that a hell of a lot more ATP can be produced. Now, if you think about this in terms of inputs and outputs, glycolysis that is, you've input a fuel, glucose, you've output two fuels, two identical pyruvate molecules. Start with a 6-carbon, you have 2 3-carbon fuels. You've input low energy oxidized coenzymes, NAD pluses, and you've made them into reduced high energy NADHs. So they are carrying a lot of the energy that was in glucose originally. Don't ever lose track of the fact that reduced coenzymes are carrying a lot of energy, even more than the ATP is. And also, you've input some ADPs and phosphorylated them into ATPs. Those ATPs are the goal. NADH, even though it has a lot of energy in it, is not the goal, so that's going to be further processed, but not in glycolysis. If we keep thinking of the NAD molecules as taxis, they have picked up their passengers in glycolysis, or these ones have. There's many taxis. But these taxis, these NAD pluses, have picked up their passengers, and that's what made them NADHs. They're not going to stay in glycolysis. Now that they have their passengers, they're going to drop them off in part of the cellular respiration process. And that's where that energy that those passengers represent can be put to use, making even more ATP. But only if cellular respiration happens. Okay? If glycolysis is the only thing happening, then there's just a little bit of ATP produced, 2 per glucose. Not enough to keep you alive. All right, well, in this talk about cellular respiration, we're on slide 14. Now, who can not look at this point and tell me what the first part of cellular respiration is? Yeah.
Oxidative carboxylation of pyruvate?
Very close, but actually what you said is the opposite. It's the oxidative decarboxylation, which is the opposite of carboxylation. Now, just like phosphorylation is adding a phosphate and dephosphorylation is removing a phosphate, decarboxylation is removing a carboxyl group instead of a phosphate. So think back to what a carboxyl group is in terms of functional groups. What is a carboxyl group? Okay, there are carbon and oxygen both in a carboxyl group, but how are they arranged and how many are there? There is a double bond.
Carbon goes to hydrogen.
And OH.
Yeah.
So you probably memorized it as residue and then C double bonded to an O and single bonded to an OH, right? Okay. That carboxyl group is part of the pyruvate. Here we have pyruvate. the end product of glycolysis. Okay, that's why it's out in the cytosol still. But notice that part of the pyruvate, which is a three-carbon fuel at this point, is this C and these two O's. One of the C is double bonded to one of the O's. This is not an OH, but it was. It's just that at the pH that occurs in living cells, the OH, the H, which is a proton and a neutron, gets deprotonated. One of the proton leaves and just goes into solution, and that leaves the electron behind, which is why this is O negative. So this is a carboxyl group. It's just a deprotonated carboxyl group, okay? And that's part of what we have left as fuel, the pyruvate. Think about what the first step or the first part of cellular respiration is in terms of the words. It's the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That means you're going to remove this carboxyl from the pyruvate. That's the decarboxylation part. And that happens as it enters, as pyruvate enters the mitochondrion, because it's produced out in the cytosol by glycolysis. Cellular respiration occurs in the mitochondrion. And so this first part, which is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, also involves getting the pyruvate into the mitochondrion. Also recall that a mitochondrion is a multiply membrane-bounded organelle, right? It has two membranes. For some reason, this book thought it was a good idea to use just a bunch of different shades of orange, like we're out of colors. But these two same shade of orange are the two membranes. This is the outer membrane, this is the inner membrane. The darker orange in between is the intermembrane space. That's one compartment. The light yellow or the mustard color in the interior of the, fully inside the inner membrane, that is the mitochondrial matrix, which is its own compartment, its own fluid. That's where the pyruvate is going in. So the pyruvate has to go through both membranes to enter the matrix. In the process, though, it gets changed. It's no longer pyruvate because it gets decarboxylated, and that's why CO2 is coming off. Okay, that's part of the dismantling of the carbon skeleton, right? This carbon that's in the carbon dioxide is one of the six that you started with in glucose. And keep in mind, there's two of these produced because you have two identical pyruvates for each glucose you started with, because it gets split into two pyruvates. So, yes, it's one per pyruvate, but you have two pyruvates. Therefore, two of the six carbons that were in the original carbon skeleton have been completely dismantled into worthless, energetically, completely spent fuel, CO2. That's why we get rid of it. Okay? You have four remaining carbons that are still valuable in terms of fuel, remaining from what was originally in the glucose. Two of them in each of the two remaining parts after you decarboxylate pyruvate. But when you decarboxylate pyruvate, it's no longer pyruvate. It now only has two carbons, the two magenta-colored ones. And ignore this brown part, this SCOA. If you have just the rest of this, that's the remaining fuel at this point. That's all that's left. You have two of them, of course, but that's all that's left of the fuel that started out as glucose. And this two-carbon compound is an acetyl group when it's by itself. It gets picked up, though. It doesn't remain by itself. It gets picked up by another coenzyme. We've talked about NADs being coenzymes, and I told you that in general coenzymes pick things up and put them, drop them off somewhere else. That's what NAD is doing. We'll see the same things happening with FAD, another coenzyme. Well, this is still another company of taxis, coenzyme A. And it's empty at first, doesn't have a passenger, but then it picks up the acetyl group, which is all that's left after the carboxyl is removed from pyruvate. It's just the two carbons. Well, I mean, that is, in terms of carbon, that's all that's left. But you still have a carbon skeleton, It's getting smaller now, so this it's been more dismantled, but you still also have valuable hydrogens. All right, now, the rest of the phrase is, it's not just decarboxylation of pyruvate, right? It's oxidative decarboxylation, which means there's a redox component to it. And notice that NAD plus gets reduced into NADH in this process, this first part of cellular respiration. That NADH and H plus is no different from the NADH and H plus that was produced in glycolysis. It's the same stuff, valuable for exactly the same reason. It's carrying a lot of the energy that was in the fuel. But it's not the end point. It's not the goal. The goal is ATP. So this is the second place where we're accumulating NADH, reduced coenzyme, in other words, that can deliver that valuable cargo to a later part of this process so that we can make even more ATP. All right? That's part one of cellular respiration. Let's then go to slide 15, which shows you part one again, but it also shows part two to show you the relationship between them. Part one, once again, is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That is shown by this top white arrow. Part two of cellular respiration is the citric acid cycle, or tricarboxylic acid cycle, or Krebs cycle. That's shown as the circle, as you see. Now, keep in mind the fuel that's remaining here, the valuable stuff in terms of energy, is more than just carbon atoms, right? But it's been simplified in cartoon form as just carbon atoms, these gray balls, even though there's more there than that. That's just to show you that the carbon skeleton is being dismantled. But pyruvate is a three-carbon fuel. It gets decarboxylated, so that's why a CO2 is produced. Remember, I said that the CO2 that you exhale is carbon that used to be in the food that you ate. And this is the first place that that happens. That leaves a two-carbon fuel, still valuable, called acetyl, that gets picked up by coenzyme A to make the overall full taxi, which is called acetyl coenzyme A. But just like a taxi, it's not going to hang on to that acetyl. It's just going to deliver it somewhere, right? Well, the place where coenzyme A drops off the acetyl is the citric acid cycle, the next part of cellular respiration. And you can see that happening here. Coenzyme A does not enter the citric acid cycle. Coenzyme A simply picks up the acetyl from the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate and then drops that acetyl off, only the acetyl, to citric acid cycle, leaving the enzyme A, coenzyme A, empty again so that it can go pick up more as long as you keep supplying it with acetyl or with pyruvate. Okay? So two-carbon compound acetyl gets put into the citric acid cycle. Now, the particulars of the citric acid cycle are not shown here. We'll see a little more detail in the next slide. But the important stuff energetically that's happening in the citric acid cycle is shown here. One really important thing that the citric acid cycle does is that it completes the oxidation of the fuel. It completes the breakdown of the fuel. Right? So think about this in terms of the overall process, not just cellular respiration, but the bigger process that we're looking at here is the complete oxidation of glucose, right? That I keep saying means completely dismantling the carbon skeleton and completely picking off the hydrogens. That's how you get as much energy as possible from that fuel. The citric acid cycle completes that process. It's starting with the fuel that's left at that point, which is no longer glucose, it's the acetyl. But it completely dismantles what remains of carbon skeletons, because there's two carbons in acetyl, not just one. And that's why one of the things that comes off of the citric acid cycle is more CO2. And it's two more CO2s for each turn of the cycle. Well, those are represented by the two carbons that are in acetyl. So it breaks down what's left of the fuel. Keep in mind, though, that you had two pyruvates originally because you started with one glucose that got split into two pyruvates. So the one carbon dioxide that comes off of pyruvate is multiplied by two because you have two pyruvates. That's two of the six. Then for each of those acetyls, you have two carbon dioxides that come off. So a total of four there. Four plus two is all six of the carbons that were originally in the fuel. Yeah?
Does that mean there's two acetyls? Or?
No. Well, yes. That's what I'm saying. There are two acetyls per glucose because there are two pyruvates. Everything has to be multiplied by two after you get to that fork in the road in glycolysis, because you have two of those for every glucose that you started with. So that accounts for all six carbons in glucose. It's been entirely dismantled into six individual one-carbon compounds that have no hydrogen in them. So these are not only useless fuel, they're no longer even organic, right? CO2 is inorganic. The fuel, in other words, by the time the citric acid cycle is complete, is gone. There is no more fuel left. Now, you've made, in terms of goals, you've made some ATP, because you made some in glycolysis, and you made some, and you make some here in the citric acid cycle. Notice ATP also gets produced. Both of those happen by substrate level phosphorylation. But that isn't nearly all of the ATP that could be produced. However, you no longer have any fuel left. So where is all the rest of the energy at this point? The usable energy, meaning the energy that hasn't been lost as heat. How can you end up making a hell of a lot more ATP when you don't have any fuel left? Yes, and what happened to those hydrogens is that they got put into taxis, right? Those hydrogens that got picked off, because you no longer have any left in the fuel, have been put into taxis. Glycolysis filled some taxis. NAD plus got turned into NADH and H plus. The oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, part one of cellular respiration, reduced some NAD plus into NADH and H plus. And citric acid cycle does this at three different places. That's why there's a three here. Three different places of the cycle reduce NAD plus into NADH and H plus. Plus, not only that, in a different part of the citric acid cycle, a different kind of taxi, a different coenzyme, FAD gets reduced into FADH2. That's where all that extra energy is. The fuel is gone. You've made some ATP, so that's some of the energy, but that's the goal. It's done. The remaining processing that has to happen is simply to deal with all this energy, which is most of the energy, really, that's being carried by these coenzymes. Okay? Now, FAD, we haven't talked about really yet. It's very, very similar to NAD. What does NAD stand for? It stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, right? It's two nucleotides held together. Those two nucleotides have different nitrogenous bases. One of them has adenine, one of them has nicotinamide. FAD is very similar, but it's flavin adenine dinucleotide, because that one of those nucleotides, instead of having nicotinamide, has flavin as its nitrogenous base. Operates very similarly otherwise. meaning that it goes back and forth between oxidized form and reduced form. Which one is the higher energy? Reduced form, yes. And the reduced form, though, is FADH2. The oxidized form is FAD. Remember that the oxidized form of NAD is NAD+, right? Which is why it took an electron just to make it into NAD before you can then add that electron and proton to make it NADH, leaving over a proton. Here you start with FAD. It doesn't have a charge. So it can take all four particles, both protons and both electrons, which makes up two hydrogens, right? That's why the reduced form is FADH2. There aren't any leftover protons. But otherwise, it operates the same way as NAD. It carries energy in the form of those particles that came from hydrogen from the fuel. It's also like NADH and H+. FADH2 is carrying a lot more energy than ATP. So it's enough energy to make multiple ATPs. But FADH2 doesn't carry quite as much usable energy as NADH. It's valuable stuff, just not quite as valuable as NADH. All right, so here we have no more fuel. We've made some ATP by substrate-level phosphorylation in two different places, but in two different places we've made several different copies of reduced coenzymes. NADH and H+, three different places, and FADH2 in the citric acid cycle. Those are carrying the energy that can be put to use making a hell of a lot more ATP if we process those passengers. And that's what the remaining part, which is part three of cellular respiration, is all about. Processing that energy that's being carried by the coenzymes. Fuel is gone. Well, let's look at 16 then, showing the actual intermediates of citric acid cycle. You can see how many steps there are. Just like for glycolysis, I don't want you to memorize all these intermediates, except for the ending and the starting one. This is a pathway, just like glycolysis is, but it's not a linear pathway. It's called a cycle because what would be the end of the pathway then feeds the beginning of the next turn of the cycle. So it feeds back onto itself. It can only continue to go around, though, if you keep adding things because of these things that get removed along the way. Okay? And in terms of carbon, what you have to keep adding to keep this working is acetyl, the 2-carbon remaining fuel, right? That's left after the carboxyl is removed from pyruvate. Pyruvate is the starting point for cellular respiration, still valuable fuel. It gets partially dismantled in part one, which is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That leaves you, fuel-wise, with acetyl, a 2-carbon acetyl. It gets picked up by coenzyme A and dropped off at the citric acid cycle. That's happening right here at the top. So notice the end. This is basically where you see the number one. That's the start-finish line of this, if you think of it as a raceway lap. At the end is oxaloacetate, and notice it has 4 carbons. The very first one, which is the next step after the finish, the first finish, is citrate or citric acid. That's why the cycle is named this. Well, notice that it has 6 carbons. Now think about what you're trying to do here. You're trying to dismantle the fuel to get energy out of it, right? Which means to reduce the number of carbons in the skeleton. But you've done just the opposite here. Because you're adding acetyl from the fuel that's left to a 4-carbon oxaloacetate to make a 6-carbon citrate. You're doing just the opposite of dismantling it, actually, in that step. But if you keep going, you can see that in a couple places, individual carbons in the form of carbon dioxide get spit off. So it does accomplish the dismantling, just indirectly, as long as you keep it turning. So these CO2s happen at different places, but these are the remaining four CO2s. You have to multiply this by two, remember, because you have two different pyruvates turning into two different acetyls. Each acetyl gets split into two individual CO2s. And there, since you have two of them, that's four more CO2s plus the two that occurred in part one when pyruvate got decarboxylated, right? That's all six carbons. Fuel is completely spent. But energetically speaking, you have NAD plus being reduced to NADH and H plus here, here, and here. That's why it said three in the previous. But it's really six because it happens three times for each acetyl. So that's a hell of a lot of energy that used to be in glucose in the form of six NADHs and H pluses, each of which is carrying enough energy to make multiple ATPs. Okay, so six of those, plus you have an FAD being reduced into FADH2 down here. And you also make ATP by substrate level phosphorylation. All of those are carrying energy that used to be in the fuel. The ATP is done. These coenzymes are not done. They need to deliver their passengers to the next part of the process so that that energy can be put into making more ATP. Well, let's look at that, slide 17. This is an introduction to this final part, part three of cellular respiration, which goes by what name, part three overall? Oxidative phosphorylation, which should tell you that ATP gets produced, right? Because phosphorylation refers to sticking a phosphate onto ADP to make ATP. That's the goal. That's already happened a couple places, but that was happening via substrate level phosphorylation. This final burst of ATP, which is actually by far most of the ATP that gets produced in the overall process, is happening a little bit differently. Not substrate level phosphorylation, but oxidative phosphorylation. And I probably won't get actually to why that, how that actually specifically differs until next time. But that's part three, oxidative phosphorylation, and it has two steps, two parts, subphases of itself. The first part of oxidative phosphorylation is electron transport. And anatomically, or materially speaking, electron transport involves collections of molecules, collections of proteins more specifically, that make up what are called electron transport chains. Now, in a lot of textbooks, you'll read about the electron transport chain, which I don't like because it implies that there's only one of them. There are millions of copies. They're all the same. But this, what you're looking at here is just one electron transport chain. They're all built the same way for this process. But don't think that there's just one electron transport chain. There's millions of them in your cells. Well, anyway, where are we within the cell at this point in the process? We are in the mitochondrion. And specifically, we are, for as far as the electron transport chains are concerned, we are specifically in the inner membrane. I don't mean inside it, which is where the matrix is. I mean that these proteins that make up the chains, they are membrane-bound proteins embedded in the inner membrane of the mitochondrion. They are part of the membrane. Okay? Now this is a two-in-one figure in a sense. It's kind of anatomical because it shows you cartoons of the shapes of these proteins. There's many different proteins here, but there's four major protein complexes called 1, 2, 3, and 4, Roman numerals. Okay, those are protein complexes, and they actually exist as part of the, many copies of them exist as part of the inner mitochondrial membrane. So that's the anatomical aspect of this figure, but it's also a graph. Notice the left edge is labeled with G, free energy. And this is why this electron transport chain, including these four protein complexes, is going downward diagonally. Because electrons get passed from members, from one member of the chain to the next member of the chain, and so on. And each time an electron gets passed from one member to the next, it goes down in free energy. So this is the stepwise release of energy that was being compared to those water wheels that we looked at in earlier slides. Rather than just one explosive release of energy that would kill the cell, this is the manifestation of that stepwise release of energies in manageable units. Okay? Now, electron transport is a process. But what that process involves materially or structurally is an electron transport chain, which is this relationship of these four major protein complexes in the inner mitochondrial membrane. Now, this is very similar. This is probably, maybe it's too old-fashioned an example for you modern people, but it's very similar to a bucket brigade, an old-fashioned bucket brigade. You know what I mean by a bucket brigade? That's because you just call the fire department if you get a fire. But if you're out in the middle of nowhere where there are no fire departments and your barn is burning, you get neighbors together to form what's called a bucket brigade because you have one well. That's the source of water. And then the fire is wherever the barn is or whatever else is burning. And so you line up. Rather than having different people run back and forth between the well and the fire wearing themselves out, they form a line, right? One person gets the full bucket and passes it on to the next person till eventually you get to the end of the line and he spills it onto the fire. And then you just keep doing that. It just means the house will burn, that's all. It's okay, so anyway, that's what this is like. That's what an electron transport chain is like, except it's not buckets of water, it's electrons that get passed from one member to the next in this chain. Now, where do the electrons come from originally? Hydrogen of what? Originally, I'm saying. Originally. Glucose, yes. The hydrogens that are in the original fuel, which is the valuable part, remember, we use that energy in the fuel by picking off the hydrogens, right, as I keep saying. Each hydrogen that gets picked off is an electron and a proton. Those are the electrons that get passed down these chains. They came from the fuel. But not directly, right? They got to the electron transport chains by being carried there by these taxi-like coenzymes that picked them up from the fuel along the way. I'm talking specifically about NAD+ picking them up to become NADH and H+, and then in the citric acid cycle also FAD picking some up to turn it into FADH2. That's where most of the energy that was originally in the glucose is at the moment, before we get to this step. So they're all actually driving their passengers to the same destination, which is the electron transport chains, or the nearest one, because there's many copies of them. Okay? Embedded in the membrane, the inner membrane of the mitochondria. Now, they deliver their electrons to these protein complexes that are members of the chain. What does that mean is happening chemically in this process? They're delivering electrons. Not just oxidizing, it's redox, right? If there are electrons being shuttled around, that means redox is happening. Things are being reduced, other things are being oxidized. If you are a full taxi, what are you, reduced or oxidized? Reduced. If you're going to finally get to your electron transport chain, which is where the passenger wants to go, and you get rid of the electrons, what's happening to you as a taxi? You're becoming reoxidized, right? But you are now reducing that member of the electron transport chain that you deliver the electrons into. Okay? And then when that member passes those electrons to the next member, the first member gets reoxidized and reduces the second member. And so on, right? Each of these little steps is a redox reaction, each of which releases a little bit of free energy. That's why it's going down in G as the electron makes its way through the entire chain. So I have to stop there, but I'm not quite done with this slide.